people across the planet got sick. 400 million died. 1 in every 18, just about.
Natasha Lawrence.
The irony today, if you want to call it that, is that people have almost forgotten just how genuinely terrifying that first stage of Hayden's was. Almost 4 million people died in the U.S. alone, mostly in those first couple of months. That's like wiping out the entire city of Los Angeles. In an average year, only about 2.5 million people die in the U.S. total. We were barely equipped to deal with all the deaths, simply from the point of infrastructure. Outside the U.S. and industrialized nations, the death toll was even higher as a percentage, and their ability to deal with the dead much lower. And that caused a huge number of problems in terms of secondary waves of disease, infection, and general political and social instability. As bad as it got for us, much of the planet had it much, much worse. There are places on the globe that still haven't entirely recovered, either in population or in terms of social structures.
Irving Bennett.
Here's an interesting fact that I learned from one of the anniversary stories coming up. It was only last year that the global population passed what it was when Hayden's first struck. They used to think we'd be at something over 8.5 billion people by now. We're 1.25 billion people short. That's not just because Hayden's killed 400 million people. It's that many of those 400 million were of childbearing age. That in the aftermath of the disease, particularly in the developing world, a whole bunch more who would have been parents died in the messes that came after. There aren't that many things that have ever put that much of a divot into humanity's growth curve. The only other thing I can think of that most people know about is the Black Death. That's pretty impressive company, if impressive is the right word to use here. And even the Black Death usually only attacked each of its victims once.
Monique Davis.
After the first several days of the Super Bowl flu, we started getting some of the same patients back into the ER, only this time suffering from symptoms that resembled meningitis. After the first few, those of us on staff started looking at each other like, "You have got to be kidding me." There was no way it could be coincidence that the same people who had been coming in for the flu were coming back with meningitis-like symptoms. The patients were different races, sexes, economic classes. The only thing they had in common was that they had the Super Bowl flu first. We started checking around at the other ERs to see if they had the same thing happening, and they did. Patients were coming back with what looked like meningitis. A lot fewer of them than in the first round. Maybe 1 in 4 or 5. But it was definitely a second stage of some sort. Now, it's possible for meningitis to be diagnosed as a flu. They share some initial symptoms. But for the same virus to exhibit flu-like symptoms, recede in most patients, and then return like meningitis in a select few? That was new. And really sort of frightening.
Benjamin Maldonado.
One of the things that researchers don't want to admit, because it sounds more than a little bit sociopathic, is how interesting the Hayden's virus was, and what things we were hypothesizing in order to explain how it was doing what it was doing. With the meningitis-like symptoms, we were confronted with the idea that a virus would attack a body, have the body's immune response beat it back to greater or lesser extent, and then, as a result, wholly reconfigure the way it was attacking the body, but only a small number of the infected. Some of the early hypotheses included reactions to blood type or specific antibodies, a signal dependent on total viral load, or a response to specific environmental inputs, like temperature or air quality, or even wireless signal. The last of those is an example of how, just because it's a hypothesis, doesn't mean it's good or useful. The point was that we were looking for some reason for the virus to apparently mutate, and that led us to be occasionally wildly imaginative in our speculation. It was the most intriguing puzzle that most of us had worked with, and we're talking about a room full of people whose job it is to work on genetic material and other natural puzzles every day. It was fun, or as fun as anything could be, up to the point when you remembered people were out there dying from the thing, and you were supposed to be putting a stop to that. Our problem was that none of our hypotheses fit the data. There was no obvious single environmental or physical factor we could find that would precipitate the change we saw in the virus, at least not in the short term. This was a problem because everyone wanted to know what they could do to counteract or at least avoid the second phase of the virus attack. And we had nothing to tell them. The only way you'd know whether or not you'd get the second phase of the attack was the headache, the stiff neck, and the other symptoms. You got it, or you didn't. This was widely considered an unhelpful response from the CDC researchers, and I don't disagree with that. We were some of the smartest scientists, geneticists, and virologists in the world. We were working as hard as we could on the problem. And it seemed like the problem was working equally hard to elude us.
Natasha Lawrence.
The meningitis phase affected substantially fewer people than the flu phase, but the mortality rate was substantially higher. About a quarter of the deaths associated with Hayden's came from people who died in the second phase. That's because the phase didn't just present meningitis-like symptoms. The virus invaded deep into the brain and started altering brain structure in significant ways. It was literally making the brain rewire its own connections. That was another thing we didn't know a virus could really do. In the lab, we would talk about this virus like it was an evil genius, like it was a Bond villain. It was a joke, and a way to have a little bit of levity in an otherwise depressing race against time. But in some ways, it wasn't a joke at all. I think the general thought around the CDC was that this virus was actually the closest thing to malicious that a virus could get.
Monique Davis.
You could see how the second phase of the virus was working in our patients, the ones that were conscious anyway. It would be like a series of little strokes, a little aphasia here, some loss of hearing or sight there, someone having a bit of Bell's palsy over on the next bed. Sometimes the patient would snap back immediately, the brain rewiring itself on the fly, I guess. And sometimes they'd just get worse. Some of them didn't progress, they just died. I had one patient stop talking to me mid-sentence. It took me a minute to realize she had passed. I honestly thought she had paused to collect her thoughts. With the meningitis phase, a lot of what we were doing, to be entirely upfront about it, was keeping the patients as comfortable as we could while we waited out whatever the virus was doing to their brain. A lot of people we couldn't help, and their bodies just sort of let go. Most survived, and most of them seemed to recover all right, with lesser or greater short-term cognitive shortfalls that were eventually addressed with therapies similar to what stroke victims get after an incident. Some experienced permanent brain damage, again, to a greater or lesser extent. There was no way to tell how bad it was going to be until it was over. And then there were the people who experienced lock-in.
Part 2, Hayden's Syndrome.
Neil Joseph, biographer and author of The President's Crucible, The First Year of Hayden's Syndrome.
I talked to David Hayden, President Hayden's younger brother, and the thing he told me that stuck in my head was that the president absolutely hated when the disease started being called Hayden's syndrome. Absolutely hated it, David said, and I remember this clearly, that it was not because it reminded everyone that he was president when it hit. It was because it was named for Margie. He hated that from the minute it stuck until the end of time. Everyone would think of Margie as being sick, of being trapped in her own self, as being the person you thought of when you thought of Hayden's syndrome. Ben married this wonderful, physical, healthy, gorgeous woman, and no one but him would ever think of her that way again.
Janice Massey, Chief of Staff for Margaret Hayden, First Lady of the United States of America.
After Margie got sick, we looked at her schedule to see when it might have happened, when that first contact with the virus might have been. After 10 minutes, we threw up our hands. The First Lady's schedule for the couple of weeks before she got sick had her at 6 events a day across 5 time zones in 2 different countries. One of those days, she came into contact with school children, hospital patients, and the Prime Minister of Canada within 6 hours of each other. The only people who come into contact with more people on a daily basis than the First Lady are toll booth operators. She could have gotten it from any of the people she met. She could have gotten it from us, her staff. Some of us got sick around the same time, and at one point half of us were out of the office with it. She could have gotten it from Ben's staff, many of whom also got sick. It was impossible to pinpoint, which makes Margie like nearly everyone else who got sick with the virus.
Colonel Lydia Harvey, M.D., retired, physician to the president.
The First Lady came to see me on the afternoon of the 13th after a staff meeting and said she was feeling achy and wanted to know if I could do anything about it. As I examined her, we talked about our upcoming plans for Valentine's Day. Well, she talked about hers, and I admitted I had no plans because my husband was as romantic as a fish, and I'm not really much better. She laughed and said the president was the same way, but she liked an excuse to have a nice dinner for just the two of them. By this time, I was obviously aware of what was then still called the Super Bowl flu. The president had been briefed on it by the CDC, and I had been allowed to sit in on the briefing because of my position as presidential physician. But the presentation initially seemed much more like the bird flu variant that had been present at the time, and I knew that the First Lady had missed her flu vaccination, an oversight on the part of my staff. I told her it was likely to be that, though it might be the Super Bowl flu instead, and that in either case she should consider canceling her schedule for the next couple of days and resting. She agreed to reduce her schedule for the next day, but was adamant about her dinner date with the president. I told her that would probably be fine.
Elizabeth Torres, personal assistant to the First Lady.
The First Lady was under the weather for Valentine's Day and for a few days afterward, but it didn't seem like whatever flu she had was getting the better of her. She trimmed down her schedule, mostly to planning sessions with the staff, made only a few unavoidable personal appearances, and kept herself hydrated. She was sick, but it was a highly functional sick, if you know what I mean. At the end of the week, she decided that she was feeling better and that she could do a full weekend schedule. This included the Maryland Winter Girl Scout Jamboree, where she was going to give a speech at the closing ceremonies. She had been a Girl Scout herself, so this was something she didn't want to miss if she could avoid it. Saturday, she was fine. If she was feeling poorly, she kept it to herself. She spent the morning using the White House studio for radio interviews and then had personal time for the rest of the day. When I left, she seemed good. No more or less tired than she might have otherwise been. I assumed that she was over the flu. Sunday morning, she said she felt stiff and had a headache, but she said she thought it was probably due to a large margarita she had while she was binge-watching old episodes of Orange is the New Black and then sleeping poorly. I suggested she might want to see the doctor on staff that morning, but she waved me off and took Tylenol instead, and then we headed off to the Jamboree.
Ann Watson, former reporter, WHAG-TV.
I was supposed to get 3 minutes with the First Lady before she went up and gave her speech, but when we arrived, we were told by her press secretary, Jean Allison, that she wasn't going to give any pre-speech interviews. Well, I was more than a little annoyed by this. The only reason we were at the Jamboree at all was because we were promised FaceTime. Otherwise, we would have just had a cameraman do the crowd shots for the last 2 minutes of the 6:30 broadcast. I told Jean that and reminded her that it was her office who set up the interview, not us. She apologized and kind of ducked in toward me and said, "Look, she's really not feeling well, and we're just trying to get her through this thing," and that she would make it up to me. Then she walked off. As she's saying this, I can see the First Lady greeting some of the Girl Scouts. Margie Hayden was very good at the public appearance face, the look of being interested or excited about something even if you don't care, and she was doing her best to use it, but you could see it slip the second she lost focus. I can't say she looked like she was in pain, but I can say that she looked very, very unhappy.
Elizabeth Torres.
By the time we arrived to the campground, she said her headache had become a migraine. I was worried because as long as I knew the First Lady, she had never gotten a headache that would qualify as a migraine. I asked her if she wanted to back out, but she said no, she could get through it. Celia Williams and Davis Armstrong, who were in charge of her security detail, also suggested that she cancel or, at the very least, limit her public time at the event. She didn't want to do that. She didn't want to disappoint the scouts.
Anne Watson.
About a half hour before the closing ceremonies were supposed to start, the organizers started trying to herd all the Girl Scouts into the bleachers. They were being told that the First Lady had had something come up and she would have to give her speech early. I could hear the youngest Girl Scouts complain because they were there for the other activities. They hardly knew who the First Lady was at all, but they were all pushed along to the bleachers. We set up at the front with the other media and had to do a little elbow throwing because we're a small market crew, but got a good spot. Off to the side, we could see the First Lady in her winter coat conferring with a young lady, I think was her assistant, and with what were obviously her Secret Service people. By now, the First Lady's public appearance face was long gone, but she wasn't on stage, so it probably isn't fair to note that. She was introduced very briefly by the head scout, I think, and then she came on. The Girl Scouts started cheering and screaming for her, and if you look at the video feed and you know the context, you can tell for her it was like being stabbed in the eardrums. But she smiled and waved and got out her notes and talked like a trooper for 5 minutes. Then she stopped, smiled, and looked off stage.
Elizabeth Torres.
She looked over directly to me, said, "I think I may be having a stroke," and collapsed.
Anne Watson.
I don't think I have ever seen people move as fast as I saw those Secret Service people move when she hit the floor up there.
Colonel Lydia Harvey.
When I learned that the First Lady collapsed in Maryland after having been sick and without a member of my staff being present, I, after an appropriate time, tendered my resignation to the President. He refused it on the basis that the First Lady did not check in with the staff to let us know she was feeling poorly. Nevertheless, it was made clear to me immediately afterwards that the refusal came counter to the suggestion of some of the top members of his team. They had questioned my treatment of the First Lady's earlier phase of the disease and blamed me for her progressing to the second meningitis-like phase. Of course, we know now that there was nothing that I or any physician could have done that could have changed the progression of the disease. But this is the wife of the President we're discussing. As ridiculous as it sounds, within the White House itself, it became political, quickly. In any event, within minutes of her collapse, she was on her way to Walter Reed, and so was I.
Wesley Auchincloss, Deputy Chief of Staff for President Hayden.
The President was in Arizona for a meeting with Western governors when he'd gotten word his wife had collapsed. They were discussing the border wall with Mexico when Presidential Assistant Clay Strickland leaned in and told him. The President stood up immediately and started to exit the room. The governor of Texas, who had been a primary opponent of his, started to complain, and the President held up his hand and said, "Bill, at this very moment, I could not give a single goddamn for your miserable wall," and walked out. I'm certain the governor of Texas never forgave the President for that comment. I am equally certain the President did not, as he put it, give a single goddamn about that.
Neil Joseph.
What was really underappreciated at the time, even after that bruising election cycle, was how much Benjamin Hayden relied on Margie Hayden. Much was made of the closeness of their relationship and how it humanized him despite him being a generally unlovable character. But most people missed just how deeply he needed her, both politically and emotionally. He wouldn't have made it into the White House without her, simply put. And when she collapsed, and it looked like she might have had a serious stroke, You could not have more effectively pulled the rug out from under the man than that. People were surprised that he literally put everything on pause to get back to her. They shouldn't have been surprised. It would have been surprising if he hadn't.
Colonel Lydia Harvey.
The president's face when he got to Walter Reed and saw his wife in the hospital bed. You would have thought someone had torn out his heart and stamped it into the floor.
Benjamin Maldonado.
Around the time the First Lady was struck with the meningitis phase, some of the phase's earliest victims were moving into what we began to recognize as a third distinct phase of the disease. In this phase, for all intents and purposes, the victim's voluntary nervous system shuts down. The victim can't move, can't speak, can't even blink intentionally. The autonomic systems in most cases continued to function, so people could still breathe, and all the other critical life functions would continue more or less as they normally would. Cognitive function was likewise unaffected, to the extent that it had not been earlier affected by meningitis. The short form of this was that people suffering from the third stage were essentially trapped inside their own bodies. They were conscious, awake, and able to think, feel, and perceive the world around them. They just weren't able to tell us they could do all these things. They were locked in. At first, we only had a few reports of lock-in, and we thought it might be the rare but not entirely surprising endgame for a small handful of meningitis phase sufferers, the next step beyond those who had developed significant cognitive impairment from the disease. But then the number exploded, and we realized that many of those who were experiencing lock-in weren't otherwise cognitively impaired, that there was no real correlation between cognitive damage and lock-in. Like the first two rounds, some people got it, and some people didn't. And one of those who got it was Margaret Hayden.
Duane Holmes, legislative aide for Len Cortez, Speaker of the House.
Nothing got done. I mean nothing. To be fair to the president, very little was getting done anyway. The Republicans had the Senate and we had the House, and neither chamber was passing much of anything that would get past the other. But each of us had our legislative agendas, and of course the president had his own, largely in line with the Senate's. So we were all keeping busy. Then the First Lady got sick and the President dropped everything. It wasn't subtle either. My boss got called into a meeting by White House Chief of Staff Kenny Lamb, who told her that until Margie Hayden got better, the President's attention was going to be elsewhere. This didn't sit well with the Speaker, because we were in the middle of trying to hammer out a long-term budget deal instead of doling out extensions like we had been doing. But Lamb made it clear the President had other things on his mind. My boss said that if he was going to be that distracted, maybe he should let Vice President Hicks take over as acting executive in chief. I don't think that went over particularly well. My boss was irritated enough to ready a few jabs at the president about it, but Senate Minority Leader Gordon Harmon and his people pointed out to her that trying to take a punch at a man whose wife was gravely ill was not going to go over well at all. The speaker agreed that she would give him a week, but that was it. Sick wife or not, she had budget priorities, and she didn't want to lose momentum on the discussion. As it turned out, a week later, two of the speaker's granddaughters were sick, and she didn't give a crap about the budget either. Nor did anyone else. There wasn't a congressperson on the Hill who didn't have family or friends who were sick. This plague hit everyone.
Phyllida Yang, professor of pathology, New York University.
Hayden syndrome really was a universal disease, and that's something that's more unusual than you might think. Part of this was that the initial vectors of infection were mobile, relatively high-status individuals, those epidemiologists who traveled across continents and came home to hospitals and universities, infecting as they went. The infection traveled as easily upward in terms of social and economic classes as it traveled downward. It wasn't an outbreak focused on one particular group, as, for example, AIDS was initially in the U.S. when it first spread among urban gay men. or as modern-day outbreaks of communicable diseases are among upper-middle-class children whose parents refuse to have them vaccinated. It went far and wide. One consequence of this was that when it struck, there was a considerable knock-on effect because it was so widespread. Medical resources were overwhelmed, of course. But that was only the most obvious effect. Businesses came to a standstill, not just because people called in sick, but because spouses and parents stayed home to tend to the afflicted. Enough truckers got sick that perishable goods went bad waiting for someone to deliver them. Nearly every corner of American life was touched, and usually brought to a halt, by the initial outbreak of the disease. And as bad as it was here, it was often worse in other countries, many of which did not have the infrastructure the U.S. had built up over the years. The one silver lining, if you want to call it that, of this universality of illness was that because everyone was either sick or knew intimately someone who was sick, there was immense political will for both short- and long-term solutions to the problems Hayden's presented. And in terms of political impetus to find solutions, no one was more motivated than the president himself.
Wesley Auchincloss.
After 3 weeks, it was clear that Margie wasn't coming out of it. Doctors elsewhere were reporting other patients by the thousands with the same issues she had. So we knew that what was happening to her wasn't isolated or unusual. And it wasn't something we could keep hidden from the press or the American people either. It was around this time that the term Hayden syndrome started to be used in reference to the disease, particularly the third stage of it. We tried to keep that from the president as long as we could, but that was a futile gesture. He heard it. Dr. Harvey and her staff confirmed by MRIs and other tests that Margie was awake and conscious, so the president spent much of his time with her at Walter Reed, talking to her and reading those mystery novels she had as her guilty pleasure. Kenny Lamb finally had to pull him aside and tell him that despite his personal pain, the country needed a president, and that president needed to be seen leading and reassuring the country in this moment of crisis. When Kenny said this, the president gave him a look that, if I had to guess, communicated supreme apathy about the needs of the rest of the country. But after a minute, he nodded slowly and told Kenny that the next morning he'd be ready to resume full activity as president.
Colonel Lydia Harvey.
I remember that the president stayed up with the First Lady that entire night. I suggested to him that both he and the First Lady needed their rest, but he said, more politely than I suspect he really wished to, that he was the president and that no one could stop him from speaking to his wife. I told the medical staff to give him and the First Lady privacy, and to intrude only if absolutely necessary. Nevertheless, around midnight, I came into the room just before heading home myself. The president was sitting on his wife's bed, facing away from me, holding her hand. I could hear him talking to her quietly. Most of it I couldn't make out, but once or twice I heard him say, "Tell me what I should do. Tell me what I need to do, Margie. Tell me." It was a strangely intimate moment, and I felt that I had intruded on something that the president did not intend nor would want me to see. I slipped out of the room before he could notice I was there, waited a moment, and then knocked on the door before entering a second time, to give the president time to prepare himself. The Secret Service agents guarding the door gave me a look when I did this, but as far as I know, they kept quiet about it, too. I think they understood what had happened.
Wesley Auchincloss.
Kenny and I came into the Oval Office at 8 a.m. the next morning and were surprised that the president already had the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of health and human services, the speaker of the house, and the majority leader of the senate in there with him. We had been under the impression that the meeting would be the usual agenda setter between me, Kenny, and the president. The looks we got from every other member of the meeting suggested to us that they were at least as surprised to be at the meeting as we were. We found out after the meeting that the president called each of them personally at around 5 a.m. and told them to be in the Oval Office or face the consequences. The consequences being unspecified, but dire. He didn't call me or Kenny, I suppose, because he knew we were coming anyway. When we were all there, the president looked at each of us and said something along the lines of, "I'll make this simple. We're going to find out what this disease is. We're going to cure it, and we're going to help the people who are locked in their bodies find a way to get out. Because we're the greatest nation in the world, and if we could build the atom bomb and put a man on the moon, we sure as hell can do this." And then Speaker Cortez said, in that way of hers, "Well, Mr. President, that's going to cost money." The president said that he didn't care. Senate Majority Leader Caleb Waters reminded him that he'd been elected on a platform of slashing taxes and cutting government expenditures. The president stared straight at Waters and said, and this is a direct quote, "That was then." Waters opened his mouth to say something else, and the president said to him that he needed to listen very carefully. This was going to happen, and that if anyone got in the way of it happening, regardless of party, regardless of position, he would screw them into the ground so hard that they would end up ass first in China. Which would have been an amusing way of putting it, except that I have never, not before or since, seen the president as deadly serious as he was being at that exact moment. Waters shut his mouth and waited for what the president had to say next. And what he said next was simple. He said to Waters and Cortez that as far as he was concerned, this initiative was the sole task of the federal government from that point forward. How they wanted to get it done in their respective chambers was up to them, but they had 3 months and no more to get a bipartisan bill on his desk, one that had more than two-thirds support in both chambers. Left unsaid was what would happen if the bill failed to materialize in the appointed time. I think in her autobiography, Cortez said she thought the president was hinting that martial law was not out of the question. There's not much that I would agree with Cortez on, politically or otherwise, but I think she was spot on with this one. To be blunt, the president was not fucking around with this one. It wasn't political, it was personal.
Duane Holmes.
It got done. It nearly killed everyone in Congress, and everyone in Congress ended up wanting to kill everyone else. But 2 weeks before the deadline, the president had the Hayden Research Initiative Act on his desk. $300 billion allocated for medical and technological research and treatment for that first year, officially and unofficially, whatever it costs to get things moving. It ended up costing $3 trillion by the end of it. That's a hell of a lot of money. It got done for two reasons. One, there wasn't anyone in the U.S. who wasn't affected by the syndrome. Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, hippie and gun nut, atheist and evangelical, it didn't matter. Someone in your family got sick. One of your friends got sick. One of your co-workers got sick. You got sick. Two, and I say this as a member of the loyal opposition, President Hayden simply would not take no for an answer. He worked to pack the congressional hearings with witnesses who would appeal on both sides of the aisle. The day former NBA star and Basketball Hall of Famer Marcus Shane came to testify, I don't think I've seen so many grown men and women act like children scrambling for autographs. And then Shane talked about how the disease had locked in his kid, and I saw Senate Appropriation Committee Chairman Owen Webster, that heartless bastard, openly sobbing into his microphone. That's when any doubt I had that this thing was going to get done evaporated. There were a few holdouts. David Abrams, who was then a backbencher representative, made a lot of noise on the radio talk show circuit about the cost and the threat of new taxes and the expansion of big government and so on, and even took a few swipes at the president, despite them being of the same party. I understand Hayden let it slide by until Abrams made a crack about the First Lady to a Tulsa talk show host. By the end of the day, as I understand it, Abrams was having a very intimate discussion with the NSA, and they showed him some pictures they had or something, and then that was the last anyone heard of Abrams until the act passed. He even voted for it and everything.
Thomas Stevenson.
I can't say that I have any recollection of the NSA ever meeting with David Abrams at the time. You might ask him. I would be interested in what he has to say on the matter.
Neil Joseph.
Look, at the end of the day, it came down to this. The president wanted his wife back. He was willing to do anything to make that happen. And he was president of the United States, which meant he was able to do anything to make it happen. As a side effect, millions would ultimately benefit from the decision, but make no mistake, Benjamin Hayden was being purely, entirely, and unabashedly selfish. He loved his wife, he was lost without her, and he wanted her back, end of story. Could you blame him for it? Could anyone blame him for it?
Part 3. The Moon Shot.
Irving Bennett.
The Hayden Research Initiative Act was sold to the public as a moonshot, as in, we went from Kennedy saying we would go to the moon to Armstrong setting foot on it in 9 years because we decided as a nation that we would, and we put the resources and willpower to work. President Hayden made it clear that he wanted the same unity of purpose here. And, of course, everyone got behind it, because the syndrome touched everyone's life to a greater or lesser extent. But it didn't change the fact that the first year of the HRIA was complete chaos. National unity of purpose is fine, but when it comes to spreading $300 billion around, logistics and a solid plan is better. And it was clear that at least at the outset, no one had a plan on how to apportion the money, to allocate resources for research and development, or to set concrete goals. The U.S. government basically threw all that money into the air and yelled, "Go!" to whoever grabbed it. Hayden and the rest of the government quickly realized that, and Hayden in particular was incensed. He may have forced the creation of one of the biggest social programs in the history of the United States, but he still had skinflint Republican in his bones. The idea that his signature legislative achievement would be seen as a call to slop the pigs was something that outraged him. He sicked Attorney General Gail Garcia on several companies and C-suite executives, including ones who had contributed to his election, an unheard-of thing in any political era, and eventually people took the hint. By the end of the first year, things had settled out into four main buckets. One was simply for the medical maintenance of all the people who were afflicted, who weren't already covered by insurance, plus more federal backstopping for the insurance companies, who were screaming bloody murder about costs. Of the three left, one was for research into a vaccine, one for research into the brain, and the one for mobility and community research. Find a cure, communicate with the victims, get them reintegrated back into the world. It was the brain research that took off first.
Ida Garza, former Deputy Programs Director, HRIA, Department of Health and Human Services.
My job was to coordinate research across several different private companies, the CDC, and other divisions of Health and Human Services, and various public and private universities, with a focus on brain research. And it was a nightmare. Primarily because each of these groups were used to shielding their intellectual property from the outside world, until such time as they could file patents or otherwise move to protect their work. The thing with HRIA was that as a condition of receiving funding, all the work, including work in progress, had to be submitted to a searchable database so that everyone else receiving funding could see the work and use it to advance their own work. Because above anything else, we had a mandate to get advances and therapies to the patients as quickly as possible. The HRIA still allowed for patent filings, but everything, everything was cross-licensed for the length of the patent, for a statutory fee that went into effect only after a product went to market. This simply wasn't the way things had ever been done before, and so I had to deal with CEOs and chair people calling me up and yelling at me that they were leaving money and profits on the table. I would remind them of just how much HRIA funding they were shoveling into their companies, and that they knew what the conditions were on that money. They would respond with baffled silence. Occasionally, one would threaten to go over my head and talk to the secretary, or, God forbid, the president himself. I was secretly delighted when they would say that, because I had a standing order, when that happened, to refer them immediately to the White House, at which time the chief of staff would read them the riot act. A couple of times, I understand, the president himself got on the line to do the honors. I was never a huge fan of President Hayden before the HRIA, but I appreciated him after the fact, because he simply took no crap from anyone about how the HRIA was run. You open up your research, or you didn't participate. And there was so much money involved that eventually, everyone gave in. Sharing data that way was not really the optimal way of doing things. If any of us at HHS could have changed it, we would have done things Manhattan Project style, where we sent all the researchers into the desert together until they came up with things we could use. But this setup allowed the communal effort to have at least a thin veneer of free enterprise, and that was politically important, considering the administration. And at the end of it all, it worked. The first neural networks came about because research on detecting brain activity by way of MRI and other external devices at Stanford was combined with physical deep brain stimulation research at the Cleveland Clinic by a scientist working at General Electric. If they hadn't been able to see each other's work, they all would have had to reinvent those particular wheels. This way, the wheel only had to be invented once.
Heng Chang, neural network developer, General Electric.
Before Hayden's, there was already a considerable amount of work being done in the field of directed brain imagery, using MRIs and other similar equipment to record and register when and how thoughts were being transmitted, and visualizing the brain as it responded to outside stimuli. At first, for third-stage Hayden's patients, that's how they communicated. Sensors would be placed on their heads and scalps, and we could very laboriously piece together their thoughts, sometimes just by running down the alphabet and having them think yes when we came to the letter they were thinking of, spelling that way. Obviously, that was a laborious process and not one that could be replicated for millions of Hayden's patients. When GE started researching Hayden's, we got access to the HRIA database, and as I was going through it, I became intrigued at some experiments the Cleveland Clinic was doing with very sensitive antenna-like filaments they were developing to track incipient seizures in epilepsy patients, with the idea of then applying deep brain stimulation to arrest the seizures before they began. I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great if the filaments could send as well as receive? You could use them to allow input from outside the body directly into the brain and send thoughts out the same way. Then I didn't think about it again because I was working on another project entirely and the clinic's work wasn't on point to that. But my subconscious mind must have been still thinking about it because about a week later, I came flying out of a dead sleep with the idea of the neural network. It was like it just downloaded directly into my brain. My reaction to it was so strong that I sat straight up in bed and actually shouted, not eureka, but just a really loud gasp. This turned out not to be a great thing because my cat was sleeping on my chest and was so surprised that she ended up digging into my skin before running off the bed. I got out of bed, swabbed the blood off my chest, and then drove to work in the middle of the night to start modeling the network I thought of. I didn't want to go back to sleep. If I did that, I was pretty sure I was going to lose it entirely.
Ida Garza.
Chang's idea was brilliant. Every scientist, on staff and off, told me so. So we knew this was a direction we needed to go, and quickly. What we didn't know was how much it would cost. There's an old saying, fast, good, cheap, pick two. Meaning that you'd never get all three at once. We picked fast and good. We didn't assume it would be cheap, which, as it turns out, was a good thing.
Heng Chang.
They told me years later that by the time we got the first fully functional neural network into production, we had burned through something like $100 billion developing, testing, and manufacturing it. That's a literally inconceivable amount of money to me. Certainly I never saw any of it other than my salary at GE. But I did get on the cover of Time magazine and was a finalist for Person of the Year, so that made my mother proud.
Irving Bennett.
So Chang and his team developed the neural network, but one drawback they had was in its testing. They could model the networks in supercomputers, which could create environments that superficially resembled the human brain, and those models got them something like 85 to 90% of the way there. But at the end of the day, if you want to find out whether they work, you have to put the networks into an actual brain. And ultimately, it has to be a human brain for two reasons. One, because animals' brains aren't complex enough. And two, because an animal isn't going to be able to talk to you about whether the network is functioning. There was also the catch that during the meningitis phase, the Hayden virus changed the structure and function of the brain so much that there was literally no useful analog in the natural world for it. If you wanted to see how the networks worked in a Hayden brain, you needed an actual Hayden brain. Naturally, this created a moral and ethical issue. These first neural networks were both highly experimental and highly invasive. The work papers Chang and his crew published described how the filaments of the network would need to penetrate and migrate through the brain matter, essentially turning the brain into a massive pincushion, without any guarantee that the invasion of this artificial neural network wouldn't kill or debilitate these Hayden patients even more than they were. When I wrote up the stories and the work papers, the families of Hayden's patients nearly rioted. They felt like their family members were about to be victimized a second time. President Hayden had to cut short a trip to Indonesia to come back and deal with it. He was not happy about it, or with me. New York Times publisher Bitsy Lapine called me into her office to let me know that the president had called and yelled at her about me for 20 minutes. Bitsy, bless her, eventually recited the First Amendment at him and hung up.
Heng Chang.
The media response to our initial set of work papers highlighted the problem that the public had in understanding how efficiently we could model the human brain and the network's interaction with it. We were very comfortable that the networks could be installed safely in nearly all cases, but there was always that tiny bit of risk that you can never get rid of, and so the press and the families focused on that. There was really no way we'd be able to get volunteers from the general Hayden population after that.
Irving Bennett.
This is where the near-universal nature of Hayden syndrome came to the rescue. The first guinea pigs for the networks were eventually recruited from three distinct groups. The first was the very elderly, people who, from an actuarial point of view, only had a couple of years of life in them even before they got sick with Hayden's. The second group was people with terminal illnesses who also got Hayden's, stage 4 cancer patients and patients with other advanced illnesses. These two groups had almost literally nothing to lose by volunteering to test these networks. The third group, well, in one sense, the people in it didn't have much to lose either. But they were still problematic, to say the least.
Chris Clark, inmate, Nebraska State Penitentiary.
I was in prison because a couple of teenagers got into the drug lab me and my stepfather Bill had in a tool shed on our property. I think they heard from someone who bought from us that we kept our inventory there. We didn't. Once we cooked it, we moved it. But they broke in, started looking around, and we think accidentally started a fire. The shed went up, taking them with it. Me and Bill were charged with 2 counts of manslaughter and a whole bunch of drug-related charges, and were found guilty. Bill died of a heart attack before he could be sentenced, and I think the judge took it out on me. I got a total of 85 years, and I would have to serve 50 before I could get parole. I was 22 when I went in. It was a life sentence on the sly. You would think it would have been hard for Haydens to get into a prison, but no, we got it just like everyone else. We joked that someone brought it in after a conjugal visit, but it's obviously more likely that a couple of the guards brought it in from the outside world. Within a couple of weeks, it seemed like half the house was sick with it. The prison only has one doctor on staff, and then some PAs and nurses. They were swamped immediately, and not a lot of help was coming in. The rest of the world had it too, and helping a bunch of murderers and rapists was low on the list of everyone else's priorities. I think I was one of about a dozen inmates who experienced lock-in. I won't bore you with the details of that. I will say it's pretty much like being in solitary every day, all the time, for the rest of your life. That should be enough to go on. I do remember one day while I was lying in the infirmary wing, where they'd permanently put those of us locked in, a nurse was talking to one of the PAs and saying that she had heard that in the legislature there were some state representatives who objected to continuing medical services to those of us who were locked in. Said it was a waste of money, and that in our case it was God meting out justice. I never intentionally killed anybody, but I would have gladly wrapped my hands around that asshole's neck. One day I hear Nebraska State Penitentiary Staff Dr. Hunter Graves talking to someone. When you've nothing to do but lie there and hear other people talk, you get good at knowing the voices of the staff. And this was someone new. Graves told this person that I was likely the best candidate in the infirmary. I had no idea what that meant. Then this person started talking to me. She introduced herself as Dr. Constance Dennis from the Department of Health and Human Services, and she wanted to know if I would volunteer for a medical procedure that would allow me to talk to people again, and maybe even get me back on my feet. They would advance my parole date by a couple of decades for my participation. The only catch was that the procedure was highly experimental and I might die. Well, shit, I thought. I'm already as close to dead as I was going to get. Anything was better than this, including actual death. When they put me into that MRI to scan my brain to see my response, I was shouting yes so hard in my head that I think I almost gave myself a stroke.
Catherine Martinez, Associate Counsel, the Prison Freedom Coalition.
We fought it. Of course we fought it. Approaching people imprisoned for life, or something close to it, and dangling parole in front of them in exchange for being medical experiments was deeply unethical medically, and extortion besides. So we fought it. And so did the ACLU and the NAACP. And we were shut down every step of the judicial line, culminating with the absolutely disastrous Hicks v. Copeland ruling. Now, in the United States, you can completely disregard the Eighth Amendment, as long as you can say that prisoner participation in a quote-unquote medical trial is quote-unquote voluntary. As if prison itself isn't a system of compulsory situations, one after the other. We set back the prisoner's rights cause by a couple of decades. It's a millstone around the neck of everyone who participated. And it's a reminder that panic, in this case about Haydens syndrome, means that justice gets compromised. The law is blind, but the people who administer it see what way the political winds are shifting all too well.
Heng Chang.
During the worst of the Hicks v. Copeland controversy, I'd get phone calls in the middle of the night. Some of them were from people telling me that I was a monster for using prisoners, and then others telling me that if I didn't pick their brother or father or whoever to take part in the trials, they would come and burn down my house. It was a nerve-wracking time, not in the least because I had almost no say on who was chosen for the trials. I can sympathize with those who thought we were doing something monstrous with the prisoners. My wife has Japanese-American ancestry. Her family tree has people in it who were interned at Tule Lake. I know mistakes can be made because people are scared. But at the same time, there were suddenly millions of Americans and millions more around the world trapped inside their bodies. In places where care wasn't as advanced as it was in the developed world, third-stage Hayden's patients were simply being left out to die, slowly starving to death. Even here in the U.S., there were entire hospitals basically being used as storerooms for the locked-in. It was an immense humanitarian crisis on a global scale. I don't know. Maybe we were wrong to enlist prisoners as trial subjects. It's something I don't have a good answer for, and yes, sometimes it still keeps me up at night. But on the other hand, we had workable, functional neural networks from the moment I sat up in bed to the moment we switched on the first Hayden patient in 18 months. That is a miracle. It really is.
Catherine Martinez.
About a third of the prisoners recruited for the trials died or suffered moderate to significant brain damage. Or, I should say, the government, only in the last 5 years, released the data which says a third of the prisoner participants died or suffered brain damage. We have reason to believe those numbers are, shall we say, conservative.
Chris Clark.
Well, I didn't die anyway. Though I had to wait until that Supreme Court ruling came down to get to participate in the trials. I was one of the second wave of test subjects. Since I heard that a lot of the first wave died or got brain damage, I don't suppose I should complain. So the way it worked is that I spent a lot of time with my head and a bunch of machines that made detailed scans of my brain. MRIs, X-rays to see blood vessels that had dye in them, that sort of thing. That took months, which didn't make sense to me. I'm not Stephen Hawking. There's not that much brain to see. Finally, they decided they knew as much about my brain as they were going to find out without actually looking at it. So they took off the top part of my skull so they could observe it directly. When they did that, they took a clear, sterile piece of plastic and put it where the top of my skull used to be, so they could see inside whenever they wanted. Then they took the part of my skull they sawed off and tucked it into my stomach area, so it would stay alive for when they wanted to attach it back onto my head. I could feel the thing when it was down there. It wasn't a very good feeling. Then they decided they'd seen enough and put the top of my skull back on, after they placed the neural network in my head. They told me that the network had tendrils that would bury themselves in my brain, but that I shouldn't be able to feel them, so I shouldn't worry about them. That wasn't exactly a lie. I couldn't feel the tendrils as they dug into my brain, but every once in a while it was like one of them would hit something, and I would get a huge rush of feeling or sensation. One time my field of vision went entirely green for like an hour. And another time, I suddenly started smelling oranges. Another time, I had about a minute where it felt like someone put a branding iron straight up my backside. It didn't last very long, but when you're feeling something like that, time stretches out. After about a week of this, I guess everything was where it was going to be, and they told me they were going to turn on the network, and that if everything worked, then I would be seeing through a camera they set up on a desk, and that I would be able to talk through a speaker. And I felt something like an electric shock, and I could see myself on the bed, bald, with this ugly scar across the top of my head that made me look like Frankenstein's ugly cousin. And I thought, Jesus, I look like shit. And suddenly I heard the words I was thinking coming through the speaker. The network was reading my thoughts. I realized I was going to have to be careful with what I thought until I could actually control myself. And then that came over the speaker. Then I started to talk to anyone who was in the room because it had been so long since I could talk to anyone about anything. I was just asking people's names and what they were wearing and about their kids and their pets. It didn't matter because I could talk again, and it was the best thing in the world. After a few minutes of this, I got a weird itch on my face, and it took me a couple of seconds to realize that I had tears, and they were just, like, pooling on my face because